Several hours due to disruption of service because of the attacks. At least 5 rail cars have been set alight this week and cables cut in what Metro Rail claims is a campaign of sabotage orchestrated by Satawu. That's the union that represents transport workers. Union Representative Evan Abramse denies the allegation.
We have no problem at Satawu in distancing ourselves of any such actions, condemning such actions. People who do endanger the lives of our members who work on the rails and the commuters and the general public.
The latest dispute between the union and Metro Rail involves end-of-the-year bonus payments. Thus far, no injuries have been reported because of the sabotage, but 2 people have been arrested. For NPR News, I'm Vicky O'Hara in Johannesburg.
And I'm Paul Brown. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Hello, I am a representative of Toyota. As you know, we can't stop laughing at your politicians. Unfortunately, the only thing funnier than Washington, D.C. is our lame excuses for out-of-control cars.
Bow, bow, help me, Honda, help me, Honda.
If you need a break, listen to the Capital Steps April Fool's edition of Politics Takes a Holiday on this public radio station.
Thursday afternoon at 1:06 on AM 580.
It's time to donate your CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment to the Vintage Vinyl Sale for the Illinois Radio Reader. Just take your donations to any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
Today's programs are made possible in part by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, celebrating their 25th year of fair trade retail in downtown Champaign. 10,000 Villages provides income to artisans in developing countries by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Here's the question that we'll try and discuss here this morning in the first hour. How should the governments of today respond to past abuses of human rights? Now, those people who have been injured, who've lost loved ones, clearly they want to see those responsible brought to justice. But beyond justice, there's also a desire for truth. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Juan Mendez. He is a lawyer, an academic, longtime activist in the area of human rights. And we'll be talking about human rights trials and truth commissions and try to talk at least a bit about what the United States might learn from some of the experiences of countries in Latin America, countries like Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Peru. Juan Mendez is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a talk. This is part of the MillerCom series. And his talk will be tonight at 7:30. And that's at the Levis Center on the U of I campus on West Illinois. All of these programs, they're always free and open to the public. So certainly we would encourage people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana to stop by and to hear Professor Mendez. But, of course, here on the program, you can listen and also ask questions. We'd like to involve people in the conversation. And you can do that very easily by calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number. We also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that. And we also do have the possibility of email, so you can send your comments and questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Juan Mendez. He is currently a visiting professor at the Washington College of Law at the American University. Between 2004-2009, he served as president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. He's a native of Argentina. He has had a long legal career working in the area of human rights and has also a long record of advocacy throughout the Americas. As a result of his involvement representing political prisoners, the dictatorship in Argentina, the military dictatorship, arrested him put him in jail for a year and a half. During that time, Amnesty International adopted him as a prisoner of conscience. He left the country in 1977 and has been living in the United States since. For 15 years, he worked with Human Rights Watch. He served as general counsel of the organization. He also has been the executive director of the Inter-American Institute of Human Rights in Costa Rica. He's taught law at Notre Dame University and also has taught international human rights law at Georgetown Law School and the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. We're pleased to have him here. And again, as we talk and as people listen, questions, comments all the way along are welcome. The only thing we ask of people is that they just try to be brief. And we ask that so we can get as many callers as possible. But anybody's welcome to join us. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
To begin, perhaps we can talk about transitional justice. It's a term I think not everybody's completely happy with, but it is the term that is applied to what we're talking about. What is transitional justice?
It has become a term of art, but you're absolutely right that that is very misleading. Transitional justice basically alludes to the way societies deal with legacies of very serious human rights abuses as they try to make a transition from dictatorship to democracy or from conflict to peace. And in the last 25 years or 27 years, there's been a series of experiments with how to deal with those legacies, with the obvious tensions between looking forward and looking back and, you know, letting bygones be bygones, but settling scores. And in essence, not only those experiments have yielded very valuable lessons that country after country, you know, reenacts, but they've also yielded some important developments in international law to the effect that in the presence of these legacies of mass atrocities, states have obligations to the victims and to the society at large. And those obligations can be, you know, classified in four obligations. One, to the truth, especially where there's been concealment and an attempt at oblivion. The state has to find out what happened and disclose what happened. Then to justice. The state has to prosecute those responsible for, at least those bearing the highest responsibility for the crimes. And that basically traces back to Nuremberg. You know, this when the crimes that we're talking about are of such entity that they are crimes against humanity, there is no choice but to prosecute and punish the perpetrators. The third is to reparations. The victims deserve reparations that at least do not insult them in their capacity as victims, and particularly that kind of restores the sense that if they were victimized or their families were victimized because they were considered second-class citizens, now, in the new democratic order, they have to be recognized as first-class citizens like everybody else. And fourth, institutional reform, because by and large these violations happen because somebody in position of powers in state institutions like the police or the military or even the judiciary has abused the power. And so in order to make these things never happen again, what you need to do is to reform the institutions and particularly exclude from them those who are known to have abused their authority. Mm.
It seems that it's worth making the point that while one can say, I'm sure, that efforts at transitional justice have been imperfect, that we are moving beyond the point, and I think you've made the point in some of your writing and speaking, that we're moving beyond the point where governments could say, this is a new day, we are moving forward, but we are going to close the book on the past. We're going to say the past is past. Nothing will be gained by going back. And there may have been reasons that they felt compelled to do that. But they said, we're going to leave that lie. Mm-hmm. And I think what you have said, and a lot of people who work in this area have said, that at the very least, you just can't do that anymore.
Yes. No, that's very clear, but I think the pressure to do it comes up again and again. I mean, for the most part, almost by definition, the powerful people who committed these atrocities are not completely powerless in the transition. They retain a measure, a modicum of power that sometimes is very strong. And at the same time, they have some support in society and in the state. And so there's always a pressure to maintain the situation of impunity. But I think it's absolutely clear in international law, but also in the state practice generally, that attempting to wipe out the past by ignoring it is just not going to happen. Even 30 years later, the demand for justice, the demand for truth, the demand for reparations will always be there. And so it's smarter for societies and for states to tackle the issue and confront the past and deal with the past. Now, how to deal and what mix of prosecutions and truth-telling and what mechanisms to do either and what kind of reparations, all of that is very much left to experimentation because it has to be homegrown. It has to come from the perspectives of the society itself, from the background to the conflict, etc. So there's no one-size-fits-all here. There are principles and there are objectives that have to be filled, but each society has to find its own way to it.
Yeah, I think that, again, you've made the argument that that it's something that must happen in order for governments to have legitimacy, for them to have the trust of citizens.
Exactly.
And without that, you cannot really move forward in the way that you say that you want.
Exactly. Just take the example of the judiciary. I mean, at the moment of transition, you need to rebuild the judiciary. But if you say, well, now we have a new judiciary, but don't ask them to deal with, you know, these crimes that are still, the wounds are still open in society, but they can't deal with it, that's the wrong way to establish the trust and confidence of the people in the judiciary. The judiciaries always have established their credibility by tackling the difficult issues, not the easy ones. And the same with the police, for example. I mean, in all of Latin America, we have a serious problem of criminality. And we don't have a handle on how to reduce criminality because we don't trust the police. And we don't trust the police because we haven't reformed it from when it had a free hand and it was manipulated by the armies or by dictatorships. And they're still operating under the same principles, even in the democracy. And so it's kind of a vicious circle. You know, we can't get a hold of the more serious problems that the new democratic order experiments because we don't deal with the past effectively. Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with this situation where you have parties that in the past have been in conflict and that some of the parties here, as a condition of moving ahead, of forming a new government, of having some sort of a new order, as a condition of their cooperation, they demand some kind of amnesty, say blanket amnesty for any crimes that were committed from this day into the past, or else we're not going to play.
Right. Well, that's exactly the way the stories unfold in all of these countries, and it's not only Latin America. It happens in South Africa, for example. The apartheid regime imposed as a condition of their yielding power to the new democratic order that there should be an amnesty. And so people think that Mandela enacted the amnesty, but he was actually served with it in the interim constitution as a condition of transfer of power. So, yeah, I mean, what happened, for the most part in Latin America, the dictatorships themselves enact self-amnesty laws for themselves, and then they expect the democratic order to respect it. And in some cases, they have for a while, and then not. In some cases, the democratic forces have felt powerful enough to overrun those amnesties. In other cases, in the early stages of the democracy, the military establishment flexes its muscle and gets the democratic government, the Congress, to enact an amnesty that is almost literally extracted from them at the point of a gun and the threat of a military coup. Either way, it's very clear that amnesties that have the effect of making it impossible to investigate, prosecute, or punish crimes that, by their nature and their massivity or their widespread nature, amount to crimes against humanity are inconsistent with the state's obligations under international law. And for that reason, they are unconstitutional. And country after country has decided that, and their judiciaries have decided that those amnesties have no validity in the domestic order. And that's why we have, even all these years later, we have prosecutions going on in Chile, in Argentina, beginning now in Uruguay, with in Peru, you know, no less than Fujimori himself has been prosecuted and convicted, and his conviction ratified by the Supreme Court, even though at first the very same crimes for which he was being prosecuted had been the subject of an amnesty that he passed for himself and his acolytes.
And you know, to what extent, if governments do this, is it because they believe that it is, in a sense, the right thing to do, or that otherwise their international standing is going to be jeopardized?
You mean they provide for accountability because they think it's the right thing to do?
Yeah. Or
I think it's a combination. I think it's a combination. I think it's an understanding that there's a shift in international law that makes it very clear that some crimes are of such magnitude that impunity for them is just not an option. I mean, that's not such a new idea. As I said before, it comes from Nuremberg, and in those years, the United States was a champion of that. But I think in the 90s, we had a major, major shift in that the international community created tribunals to try atrocities committed in the former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda, then supported domestic and mixed tribunals in Sierra Leone, in Cambodia. And more specifically, came up with this International Criminal Court, in which now 111 countries have ratified the Statute of Rome, that in effect, in addition to create a court, what it does is a pledge of cooperation between all states in the international community that crimes like genocide, like crimes against humanity and war crimes are not going to be allowed to go unpunished. So there is a major shift, and not only the leaders of these emerging democracies, but even their judiciaries understand that that the struggle against impunity is not a matter of choice of policies. It's a matter of obligation.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Juan Mendez. He's a currently visiting professor of law at Washington College of Law at American University. He is a lawyer, academic, someone who has had a long career working in the area of human rights in the Americas particularly. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking about human rights trials and truth commissions tonight at 7:30. This is an event in the MillerCom series. So anyone welcome, anyone interested to attend is certainly welcome. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I know that you've said that in Argentina, where you grew up, that you feel that the fact that for now more than 20 years there has been a stable democracy there rests on the fact that the kind of things that you've talked about actually were done. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about that as a kind of a concrete example of what we're talking about.
Right. Well, in fact, Argentina has lived an unprecedented 27 years now of democratic governments, and it's unprecedented for Argentina. I'm not saying that it's a big achievement for other countries, but for Argentina it is. And I have to say there's many reasons why democracy has been disappointing in Argentina on a variety of scores. But on one thing that I very firmly believe the democratic order has been stable because early on and later on as well, we in Argentina did the right thing about the atrocities of the past. We did not let them go unpunished. There was a truth commission, one of the earlier ones, chaired by the famous author Ernesto Sabato, that did a wonderful job of describing exactly what the phenomenon of disappearances was like. And then there was the highlight of the prosecution of the 9 junta members that had governed the country before. This is under the presidency of Raúl Alfonsín. Then there was backtracking, certainly. There was, under pressure of the military, the Alfonsin government passed two laws that had the effect of being amnesty laws, although they were not called like that. And then Menem, his successor, pardoned the military. But the struggle never ceased. The victims groups and the human rights organizations were able to extend their agenda to the rest of society to the point where from 1983 until now, every opinion poll shows that 70-80% of the population don't want those crimes to go unpunished. And therefore, and in 2005, the Supreme Court declared those laws unconstitutional and opened up the possibility of prosecutions again. When now there's been at least 10 or 15 convictions already in this second stage, and there are many. There must be at least 400 people awaiting trial for different types of crimes and different levels of responsibility. I credit our stability and the fact that no one in Argentina, even in the worst moments of our economic debacles, like in 2001, nobody wanted the military to come back. And even the military don't want to come back, because the military is reformed in Argentina as well. And that is great for democracy, because you can have many, many problems and you can have many reasons to be disappointed in democracy, but at least now you know that alternatives to democracy are worse and they're not worth the effort. And that just gives a bottom line of where society wants to go that is very healthy. And it would not have happened but for the fact that we did not let this story go untold. Yeah. And I mean, I feel this very strongly as an Argentine citizen, but there's been some studies from the social sciences that actually try to document this and publicize it and document it and prove it in a much more scientific way.
And just for a second to continue with this, as you said, one of the essential elements of transitional justice is justice in the sense of people being charged, tried, and facing consequences right. for crimes. People who were involved in the dirty war, whether they were at the command level or whether they were the people who were actually then carrying out those orders, have faced significant penalties?
Yeah, I mean, there are several of these recent convictions that I mentioned carry life terms or 25 years, 30 years. There's also lower ones, and I think it's appropriate because there are different levels of responsibility. I don't think you see too many slaps in the wrist, but of course, you know, sometimes that's a matter of opinion, and some victims may feel that about a specific case, but there's also been acquittals because it shows that the courts are serious about this. This is not an automatic conviction. If there's no evidence, there's no evidence, and these people have the presumption of innocence, and they have a right to a fair trial. And if you know, even if we all in our hearts know that they are real rascals and that they should be punished, if they're not punished by the due process of law, they should not be punished, and they aren't.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. We are very close to our midpoint already, so again, we'll try to get in as many people as we can, but callers will help us by keeping their comments brief. We'll start with Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Could your guest articulate the history of both, South America is what we're talking about, and Chile and Argentina, and the roots that go back to England there, and the Spanish invasion, and all the atrocities heaped upon the indigenous peoples, and then the influence of money, the bourgeois class, who, just like they walked at Nuremberg, they walk out the door or never tried or put in an appearance and are never prosecuted. And those folk are the perpetrators of the conversation of today. Thank you.
Well, obviously, prosecutions for a crime like torture, for example, you have to start with who, you know, it has a criminal law component to it. You have to start with the actual perpetrator of torture, and then you go through who gave the order and who facilitated it, and I am completely in favor of going as far as it'll go. But I also have to say that the principles of criminal law are not very helpful in trying to establish, you know, historic or moral responsibilities, and they should not be used for that. But that's why I think prosecutions are central to any program of transitional justice, but they cannot be the only answer. They have to be integrated with other forms, non-judicial forms, of coming up with a story of justice that is much more complete. And that's why truth commissions go a long way in doing this. And I have to say that most of the truth commissions that I know of have not skirted the issue of complicities of a moral nature, not criminal, but moral nature, and have not, made an effort to conceal that. For example, the most recent report is the Truth Commission of Peru, and it deals very extensively with the ancestral problem that the caller mentioned of the subjugation of indigenous peoples, and relates it to today, to what happened in the Dirty War when they were victimized by Sendero Luminoso, but also by the armed forces of Peru. And it relates exactly why they were victimized or what made it possible for them to be victimized, relating it to the 500-year history. So, and of course, it then comes up with recommendations to avoid the exclusion and the marginalization of indigenous peoples. Now, with respect to what the caller called the bourgeois class, as classes, it's difficult to say, you know, everybody is responsible. And I would have to say that there's a trap there that we have to avoid, because if everybody is responsible, then nobody is responsible. And you know, I can assume my share of, you know, taking Argentina where we took it, but I will never accept that I or my family or my members of my, you know, lower middle class have anything to do with the atrocities. I mean, those were really perpetrated by the military. And yes, they had support in some upper classes. And yes, some enterprises, for example, or actually some executives of enterprises were involved in some aspect of concealing this. Those things have been revealed as much as they can be revealed through truth commissions and in a much lesser part through criminal trials.
Mm. Well, it strikes me that is in as much as having finding the truth and putting the truth out there is difficult, and bringing people to justice is difficult. Maybe the ultimate test is this fourth thing that you talked about, and that is, can you make a new kind of social order that actually puts into place the kind of values that you want, and doesn't just give lip service to those values,
right,
but actually makes them real living things that will touch the lives in positive ways of all citizens.
Right. Well, I mean, the transitional justice mechanisms can go a long way in helping societies make those decisions. But ultimately, we have to understand that creating a new social order is a democratic task, and it cannot be done by a truth commission. It cannot be done by a judge prosecuting, not even a Supreme Court prosecuting people. It has those efforts can really help a lot in that, even if interpretations of history will always, you know, go in different directions, at least they establish a factual basis so that permissible lies, impermissible lies are not going to be allowed to stand. That's what truth reports are really about. But they're also about making recommendations for the future and giving a whole historic and sociological background to why atrocities happen. In that sense, they are useful for people who have to make the decisions. But hopefully those decisions will be made democratically by the society itself and not by these mechanisms.
We are just a bit past our midpoint here, and we have another caller. Let's go to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned international law as if it was an equivalent law to national law. And actually, I think it's accurate to say it, despite the fact that lawyers like to call it that. International law, I think, is a reflection of the power relationships between societies and between nations. And the example I'll give is that we really don't see international law or any of these human rights being imposed in any real way on issues like Chinese invasion and genocide in Tibet, like the ongoing genocide in Sudan, despite the fact that there's a international uproar about it. And, I mean, I could give other examples. We don't see it in terms of issues in South America with Cuba or with or we could even go to the Truth Commission issues. You brought up South Africa. Even though there were Truth Commissions focused on the apartheid regime, but we also have to look at the issues with the so-called freedom fighters who committed all sorts of atrocities and who got away with at most a slap on the hand in much of that. So the question is, are we mixing words when we talk about laws within a society and then trying to talk about laws between and among societies, which is really a matter of treaty relationships and power relationships, and unfortunately only reflect who are the winners and who are the losers in these power conflicts.
Well, I think you mentioned the fact that international law for some people is just not law because it doesn't have the instruments of coercion that you associate with a domestic jurisdiction, with a national jurisdiction. I have to disagree, but to concede a major point. International law is rudimentary. It's in early stages. It's almost primitive law, if you will. But I have to disagree that that international law is really power relations and domestic law is not. I mean, domestic law is also about power relations, and you get what you can get away with in domestic law as well. And more specifically, international law has made great strides recently. We are nowhere near the level of enforcement and predictability that we would like to have. But if you look only about 200-300 years ago, there's a big change, and there are not only instruments like courts and other things, but and organizations like the United Nations, but there's also some level of ability to put pressure on states that are reluctant to accept an international order, and more they don't get away with it. Say, for example, in Darfur, al-Bashir pays a very heavy price for committing the atrocities that he committed in 2003. Should he pay a higher price? Of course, I completely agree. I hope someday he will face justice in the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, the fact that he has been indicted is it cannot be just dismissed. It's probably a very helpful thing in order to come to a solution in Darfur. The same with everything else. I think your international law does not distinguish between rogue states and rogue insurgent movements. If they commit atrocities, they are also subject to international law and to domestic law wherever possible. So I am not saying here that transitional justice is about right-wing regimes only. It's not. It's about just crossing the line between fighting your enemy with clean hands and committing atrocities. It's when you cross the line, there is an international standard, and I agree that's not enforceable as well as we would want, but it exists and it is there. And significantly, many domestic jurisdictions are increasingly accepting that there are at least some basic international law rules that are binding on them, including the Supreme Court of the United States in the four cases dealing with decisions of the Bush administration in the global war on terror. they have mentioned international law standards as binding on the United States, particularly the question of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions.
We have a little bit more than 15 minutes in this hour focus. I need to go on to another caller, and also I would like to introduce the guest again for people who might have just tuned in. Juan Mendez is a lawyer, an academic. He's currently visiting professor of law at Washington College of Law at American University. He also has served as president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. He's a native of Argentina, where his work representing political prisoners ended up making him a political prisoner. Amnesty International at that time adopted him as a prisoner of conscience. He was submitted to torture, administrative detention for a year and a half. He was expelled from the country in the mid-70s and since has been living in the U.S. He has worked with Human Rights Watch. He has been the general counsel of Human Rights Watch, also executive director of the Inter-American Institute for Human Rights in Costa Rica. He's also taught law at Notre Dame University and at Georgetown Law School and also Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk on this subject, Human Rights Trials and Truth Commissions. It's a MillerCom event. That's tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Center. Anyone interested should feel welcome to attend. Questions are also welcome here, too. We have another caller, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's caller in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would suggest the previous caller could have made a better case had he cited examples of the Bush administration breaking international law and the unlikelihood that they will ever be brought to justice. And I'm thinking of Guantanamo, of instances of use of torture and such. However, I would point out that there were laws on the books in this country about murder in the first part of the 20th century. But perpetrators of lynchings were very rarely prosecuted and certainly almost never punished. So I think there's a parallel there between domestic law and international law. If the willingness to enforce the law is not there, it doesn't always apply. Thank you.
All right. You can comment on that in any way that you might like.
No, I think that was a good illustration of the point I was trying to make, that the difference between international law and national law is more apparent than real. But again, I want to stress, I'm not going to say that international law has the reliability, the predictability, and the enforcement capacity that we do expect from an organized national jurisdiction.
Well, and I think that you have not avoided criticism of the United States government on these issues as well.
No, of course not. I mean, in my role at the International Center for Transitional Justice and even now as a teacher, I have several times talked about the obligation that the United States government and Congress have of, taking a good look at what transpired in the global war on terror, especially treatment of detainees and particularly torture, but also several other things. And I think there are lessons, mutatis mutandi, certainly, but lessons to be learned from the experiments that have happened in other parts of the world. It's very easy for American leaders to say, we're not Latin America, or even for Karl Rove to say, completely misreading, maybe very deliberately misreading what happened, saying that truth commissions are what military dictators in Latin America use against their opponents. That's exactly the opposite. I mean, those in Latin America, it's the democratic forces that want accountability, and it's the military forces and the right-wing forces, sometimes supported by American conservatives, that want impunity. But the real lesson is not that the United States should have a truth commission. It's not that the United States should do what Argentina and Chile are doing. The real lesson is there are ways to do this, and the United States has an obligation to its citizens, to the society, to find out and go to the bottom of what really happened with the different aspects of the global war on terror that have at least crossed the line, not only of international law, but also of constitutional law in this country as well.
I guess I do find myself going back to the comments of the caller before this one, in, at least in this sense. And I'm sure that you would say that as you look at what's happened in countries, you go from place to place. Every place is different. Every
Absolutely.
Place has to be dealt with as an individual case, that this is certainly an imperfect kind of process. But then I suppose the question is that in a situation like that, is it really possible for all of the parties to come to the table with equal kind of power, or is it possible that some party will not be held to the same standard? And that might indeed depend on, you know, how things work out.
Well, I mean, I think it's desirable for all democratic forces of whatever ideological stripe to live up to the standards of the Constitution and of international law as well. One big difference, I think, one significant difference between the transitions in Latin America to democracy and the present moment in the United States is, first, this is not a transition. I mean, there's never been an interruption of constitutional order here. Second, in Latin America, the dictators certainly have supporters, but there's never been an organized party that stands for impunity. Generally, in one or another measure, conservative and progressive parties alike want to take a look at the past and reckon with it honestly, sincerely, and move on to the future, but not by forgetting the past. And here in the United States, my big disappointment in the last year is that the Obama administration has been more prone to letting bygones be bygones and not offending Republican sensibilities by, not insisting on investigations and eventual prosecutions if there's room for prosecutions. Mm-hmm. I think, quite frankly, we owe it to ourselves, and here I speak as an American citizen because I am that now. We owe it to ourselves to look at this honestly, and it may lead to some prosecutions, or maybe it doesn't. But even if it doesn't, first, we cannot just bury the past. We have to look at it. I do have to say that I credit the Obama administration with some significant changes. For example, torture is no longer, justified in any way. Now, the Uniform Code of Military Justice is back in force, and that's the way it should have always been. There are no extraordinary renditions. There may be renditions to justice, but not to torture anymore. There are no black sites, as far as I know. I mean, I hope I'm not disappointed in the future, but it looks like there isn't. But we haven't really looked at the bottom of what happened at Abu Ghraib, what happened at Guantanamo, what happened at Bagram, or what is maybe even happening now at Bagram. And we do have to look at it. And I'm also disappointed that Guantanamo is still there. I mean, there's been an effort to close it down, and the numbers are lower and all that, but it's taking a long time to do this. And I think the reason is, trying to be too bipartisan about this. I mean, if you try to be bipartisan with a party that wants impunity, you go to the lowest common denominator.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus with Juan Mendez. He's a visiting professor of law at Washington College of Law at American University, someone who's for a long time been involved in issues of human rights here in the Americas. He's here to give a talk tonight on the campus. I have an email here from someone, and I don't know if you can comment on this, who is interested in cases like that we're talking about, where countries are looking at past abuses of human rights, and whether they should take into account the fact that foreign governments have perhaps been involved in aiding and abetting some of that criminal action. And I assume that what the person is thinking about, if we're talking about Latin America, the fact that some of those governments that were abusers of human rights were supported by the United States.
Yeah. Well, I think the efforts at truth-telling in Latin America have not skirted that issue. They have mentioned it. They have not centrally focused on it, and I think appropriately so, because in a way, if we blame it all in the United States, we eliminate the guilt and responsibility of some powerful actors in our domestic societies. I mean, the theory of dependency, as it was called back in the 60s, is very useful to understand what's happening, but it can be taken too far. And it can be taken to a point where we really don't, you know, we leave off the hook the people who make dependency possible by being the link to the foreign influences that that cause the kind of things that happened. In that sense, I think there's been several truth-telling exercises that have mentioned the kind of support received by you know, perpetrators of human rights violations by the United States in, you know, training schools like the School of the Americas, etc., but not only by the United States. I mean, there's French counterinsurgency techniques were imported into Latin America as well, for example, and even today there may be some influences between Latin American countries that that should not be hidden or ignored. But at the same time, I want to stress that because the inquiry is about what really happened and who did what to whom, you start there and then you find out. And if the information leads you to complicities outside the country, you have to mention them. But if you start by, you know, the prejudice that, you know, it's all part of a big imperialistic conspiracy, you really don't get very far.
Here is another email, and I'm interested in how you might respond, from someone who's listening and says, while they typically agree with most of the goals of international law, they're perhaps troubled about how international law is made and how it may be changed. And I think that the point that the guest is making is that here domestically, that he knows who his representatives are. And if he has concerns about law, that he can always work with them. The question I think he raises is, well, in a democratic sense, how can any individual who is subject to international law actually have a voice in forming or modifying those laws to which they conform? So that, that's sort of that's this question. Well, who makes international law? How is it made? Where is it made?
Yeah, and I understand the argument, and it's also undoubtedly very true that international law does not have a democratically elected parliament, you know, making laws, because it's a community of nations, not a community of individuals. If we wanted to have a community of individuals, I think those you know, people like the caller or the writer of the email would object to it, because, you know, we don't want, you know, Chinese citizens deciding for us what we want to do here. But that doesn't mean that international law does not get made. And obviously that doesn't go to the content of international law either. International law is made by custom, by the practice of nations dealing with each other, but also by treaty making. And treaty making, you know, the states that represent, that sign, that negotiate and sign a treaty and then ratify it, there is some mechanisms of democratic decision-making, because you come back and get it ratified by the parliament or the Congress or the Senate in the case of the United States. So there is some democratic oversight, if you will, of the treaty-making. And essentially, very importantly, in the last 50 years and accelerated in the last 15, the international law that is made is about people. It's about individuals. It's about rights. It's about protecting the individual against the power of the state, and even against the power of various states. Now, you can disagree with how that law is made, but you cannot disagree with the content. Content is very potentially very good for liberty, very good for freedom, for respecting the dignity of human beings everywhere.
Well, here's another email that perhaps takes this a step further and introduces the complicating factor of national sovereignty. The person here is raising the issue of places like Rwanda, for example, places that have been called, and we'll put it in quotes, failed states. If you have something going on, say you have genocide going on, mm-hmm. and if you have a state that does not have a strong or willing governmental infrastructure, maybe they just don't have any governmental infrastructure, then what sort of duty might there be or obligation by outside states to intervene?
Yeah, I think the caller is referring to the evolution in international law about the doctrine that's called responsibility to protect. And I was, you didn't mention it, but I was briefly the special advisor to Kofi Annan on the prevention of genocide, yes. And I had to deal with this extensively. The sovereignty and equality of states is still very much the basis of international law, no question about it. But it's also very clear that sovereignty is accompanied by responsibility. A state cannot claim absolute sovereignty to commit genocide, for example, or to commit other mass atrocities. At that point, the responsibility to protect shifts from the state to the international community. And it could be responsibility to aid the state to do what it's willing to do but unable to do because it's a failed state. But it also has to be to step in and not let the state commit atrocities and hide behind sovereignty. I think, this is very incremental and it's going very slowly and it's by no means where we want it to be. But I think there's a increasing understanding and a common understanding that this is the way international law in the 21st century should operate.
In about a minute, which is as much time we have left, at the beginning, I ask you to talk a little bit about transitional justice and what it is. And you talked about the fact that there were a number of factors, truth-telling, justice, reparations, institutional reform. There is perhaps a fifth thing that sometimes people talk about that is maybe more difficult and maybe not possible to legislate, and that is reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Do you think it plays some role?
It's interesting that some of my colleagues think there's a fifth leg to this. My sense, and it's my opinion obviously, is that reconciliation is the ultimate object of the whole exercise. It's not a separate series of mechanisms that you can incorporate and that go parallel with truth-telling prosecutions, etc. But I do say that in some cases, and again the example of Darfur is one of them, even if you did eventually truth-telling prosecutions, reparations, and institutional reform, you would still need to produce reconciliation between ethnic groups that have been manipulated to continue to fight each other. And there may be some very specific reconciliation type mechanisms that are needed. Like, for example, inter-ethnic talks or intercommunal talks about land use, about water use, about grazing rights for cattle, about restitution of property. All of those things cannot be, limited to truth-telling and prosecutions or reparations. So reconciliation in those cases may require certain other things. But otherwise, if the violations have not had an ethnic dimension or a religious dimension, the rest of the mechanisms have to be inspired in the need for reconciliation.
There we must stop. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from our guest, Juan Mendez. He'll be giving a talk on human rights trials and truth commissions. This is part of the MillerCom series. That will be tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. They're always open and free to anyone who would like to attend. Juan Mendez is a visiting professor of law at Washington College of Law at American University. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. It's been a great opportunity. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Birch Tree Counseling and Consulting in Champaign, Cannon Farm in Camargo, Carpet Weavers in Champaign, Dick's Pharmacy in Arthur. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible, and thanks. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. At this point, we'll pause as we usually do so we can bring you an update on the markets and some news from National Public Radio at the top of the hour, and then we'll be back with more Focus, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where in Kansas City, May wheat is trading 464 and three quarters, up three. July, 476 and a half, up three and a half. September is at 488 and three quarters, up three and a half. May wheat at the Board of Trade in Chicago, 454, up three and a half. July, 465, up one. May corn, 346 and three quarters, up one and three quarters. July, 358, up one and one half. December, 379 and a quarter, up three. May beans, 940, down one. July, 942, down eight. And November, 918 and three quarters, up three quarters. May soybean meal at 267 is up $1.20. July is at 265, up 30 cents. May soybean oil is at 38.66, up 35. July